It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. As humans, we know we have an impact on our environment, the plants, animals, the atmosphere around us. That's been going on, though, for a very long time. About as long as humans have been evolving, we've been changing the evolutionary paths of our planetary co-inhabitants. Sometimes that's been intentional, sometimes not. Now we have lots of high-technology tools that can speed up the process, including different gene-editing technologies. We want to hear what you think. We're going to be settling into all kinds of ethical and moral questions, so bring your questions and comments on all the following: cloning, genetically modified trees, plants, animals, food. Ever had an impossible burger? What questions do you have about saving endangered animals, using our tools to prevent further extinctions? What's your vision for a future where humans cohabitate more productively with our natural world? Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Beth Shapiro is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's author of the book How to Clone a Mammoth. Her latest book is called Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Your book looks at modern biotechnology through the lens of, like I said, 50,000 years or so of human modification of the environment. What led you to look toward lessons from the past for these big decisions we face right now?
Well, you know, my research is in a field called ancient DNA. I work out in the Arctic mostly because that's where DNA preserves better, collecting bones and teeth and hair and stuff like that from plants and animals that used to be alive. And my goal with my research is to understand what made some species or populations more resilient in the face of past periods of rapid climate change, like warming after the last ice age or the first introduction of humans. And what we've learned over the decades of studying ancient DNA is about the tremendous impact that people have had on the plants and animals with which we share this planet. And today, you know, we're facing these enormous decisions that we have to make about how far we are willing to go using our new technologies to try to protect the species and spaces that we appreciate and know around us. And it's useful, I think, to look into the past to understand better how it is that we've been manipulating species for a long time. It helps to think that, to realize that we aren't suddenly moving into the role of manipulating or messing with or really causing species to evolve in a particular way, but have been in this role for some time.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of humans as an evolutionary shaper of the world around us?
Yeah, so in the book, I kind of divided it up into technological periods. So the first evidence that people were really messing with the evolution of other species comes from the fossil records of the continents around the world, where as soon as people start moving out of Africa and into other parts of the world, we see evidence that they are hunting species. Species are becoming extinct. We're changing the landscape, and that's reducing habitat available for species. And this, of course, was not intentional. We didn't turn up. Our ancestors didn't turn up in a place and plan to drive species extinct, but it was a consequence of how we were changing the landscape when people got there. And then somewhere around 10 to 15,000 years ago, it changed or began to change. And this is really the beginning of the, they call it the Neolithic, or the period where you start seeing domestication and agriculture. People realized that the driving species or populations extinct was not an inevitable consequence of finding enough food to keep their families fed, and began to try out different strategies, like not taking animals that were reproductive, taking only males or older females, leaving the females that could reproduce in the population so that that population would survive. And then, of course, the animals that they were hunting came closer. They were brought closer to human settlements. And this was the beginning of herding technology. And through this, we started to learn about animal behavior and reproductive cycles and really becoming herders and hunters, herders and caretakers rather than just hunters. And that went on for some time. And we succeeded because of our success in agriculture and farming and in becoming proficient at keeping things like cattle and goats, etc. And there became a lot of us, and all of our animals and plants started taking over all of the wild spaces. And then somewhere between 100 and 200 years ago, we went through yet another technological transformation where we moved from being herders and hunters and farmers to realizing that if we really want to see other species on this planet, we're actually going to have to become caretakers. And this was the early part of the conservation movement. Now, a lot of people think of conservation as leaving things alone. Let's stand back and let the Earth be just fine. But in fact, what conservation is us deciding who gets to survive, who gets to reproduce, where different plants and animals get to live. And as we transitioned to caretakers, to protectors, we took over the evolutionary trajectories of everything that we interact with, not just those species that we consider our domesticates. So it's really been a change. We've gone through several different technological innovations in this time.
We're talking to Beth Shapiro. Her new book is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, Beth, a big new toolkit now with genetic modification technology, which covers a lot of different technologies, I know. I think people might look at this and say, okay, yeah, we bred animals or we selectively killed this animal, not that one. Slow changes that took generations to make. Biotechnology feels a little different. We can tweak a gene and have it in the wild by next year. Is there something qualitatively different that should make us think of biotechnology in a different way than all the stuff we've been doing for tens of thousands of years?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it would be unfair to say that there isn't something different about what we're doing now. But we also have to think about the potential benefits and where we've been. I mean, a lot of people are nervous about using gene editing to help change things that we eat, for example. We can go in and we can tweak a gene and we can make papayas resistant to ring spot virus, which are papaya virus, we're killing the papayas in Hawaii, for example. Or we can tweak a gene and turn something up and down that makes something taste a little bit better. This technology is kind of scary because if we don't really understand it, because we're going in and we're trying to mess with stuff and maybe there's some unintended consequences. What people often don't remember is that the plants and animals that we have today are not just the consequence of very careful selective breeding, but we do things, for example, called radiation breeding, where we'll stick a whole bunch of baby plants into an environment where we just zap them with radioactivity or with chemical mutagens and cause tens of thousands of mutations. And we get things like ruby red grapefruits and renin wheats. These are all products that we're not scared of because they're not genetically modified in any way, but they are products that we have caused tens of thousands of uncharacterized mutations to occur and just pick the ones that we like. So we are doing crazy stuff that isn't genetic editing or genetic engineering that, you know, I mean, there's nothing inherently scary about mutations. That's not why I'm bringing this up, but it's strange to be worried about going in and making one very specific mutation like we can do with gene editing, but not worrying so much about making 10,000 mutations in mutation breeding and ending up with delicious ruby red grapefruits.
Last time you joined us, we talked about the idea of de-extinction, bringing back, say, a mammoth. And you were excited, more excited, I think, about the idea of using these kind of technologies to prevent extinction. So I want to dig into one case study that's close to my heart, the black-footed ferret, which was really close to extinct, about as close as you can get to being extinct without being extinct. Can you talk a little bit about the black-footed ferret story and where some genetic interventions could make a big difference?
Yeah, this is a great story and one of my favorites. So, you know, black-footed ferrets, they're this little predator that lives across the plains, and they eat prairie dogs. And during the early and middle part of the 20th century, there was this massive prairie dog eradication program because they're nuisances. You know, they can break down roads and infrastructures, and they get in the way of farms. And the successful prairie dog eradication program also was pretty successful at eradicating black-footed ferrets. In fact, black-footed ferrets were one of the original species listed when the Endangered Species Act first came into being. And I think it was the middle of the 80s. They captured the last living black-footed ferrets and put them into captivity and had really very little luck having successfully breeding them in captivity. And they thought they were extinct until a black-footed ferret was discovered near Meteetse, Wyoming. And this was amazing to everyone because they thought this whole species was extinct. And here it was, another opportunity to see if they could figure out how to do captive breeding for the black-footed ferret. So they brought these animals in, and everything looked pretty good for a while. They were finding healthy ferrets in the wild. And then suddenly they weren't finding any more healthy ferrets. They were only finding sick or dead ferrets. And in a last-ditch effort, they brought as many individuals into captivity as they could and tried to breed them. They had success finally when they got one individual whose name was Scarface, and he was the first male to actually breed any of the females in captivity. And this captive breeding program has been a tremendous success. Black-footed ferrets are released into the wild every year, and those populations are a little bit successful, but there's still one really terrible thing that happens, and that is that black-footed ferrets, when they're released into the wild, they will catch and kill and eat a prairie dog, and that prairie dog is often infected by introduced sylvatic plague. And these black-footed ferrets get plague, and they die. And so there are a couple of options that people have been looking into to try to help black-footed ferrets to survive using the tools of new modern biotechnologies. And the first is that there's a place in San Diego called the Frozen Zoo where there are tissue samples from black-footed ferrets that lived prior to this first near extinction that were part of this first captive breeding trial program that didn't work. And about a year ago, Revive and Restore, which is a nonprofit out of Sausalito, California, partnered with the San Diego Frozen Zoo and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to start a program to see if they could clone animals from those frozen tissue specimens that are in the San Diego Frozen Zoo. And a few months ago, an individual, a girl, a little girl, black-footed ferret kit called Elizabeth Ann was born. And Elizabeth Ann's, her DNA, her genetics show that she is distantly related to all of the individuals that are in the captive breeding program. And she, as soon as she is old enough, will be entered into this captive breeding program and will make an eighth founder individual. Eight founder individuals for the entire living population of black-footed ferrets. So she, her DNA will be a welcome bit of diversity into this population. But it might not necessarily solve the problem of sylvatic plague. And for that, they're looking elsewhere. So the cousin of the black-footed ferret, the domestic ferret, evolved with sylvatic plague and is naturally immune to it. So this partnership, again, between Revive and Restore, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and several other academic institutions in the San Diego Zoo, are now working to figure out why it is genetically that domestic ferrets can't get plague or don't get sick when they get plague. And once they've discovered that, their plan is to use genetic engineering to introduce that bit of domestic ferret DNA into black-footed ferrets, essentially creating an animal that is 99.999% black-footed ferret and 0.000, some number of zeros, 1% domestic ferret, but that is not able to get plague. And this is an amazing example to me of how these new technologies, including genetic modification and gene editing, could be used to help species to adapt to today's environment, where evolution, natural selection, isn't going to be enough for these animals to survive. But we can help them using these tools.
We're talking to Beth Shapiro, professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her new book is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Evolution Refined and Redefined Nature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of using these kind of genetic tools to modify animals to save them from extinction, as we were just hearing about the black-footed ferret there? Do you have questions about this work, how this works, concerns about it? How about genetic modification to fight pollution, to create mosquitoes that die out on their own or maybe don't spread diseases like malaria? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Beth Shapiro from the University of California, Santa Cruz, talking about her new book, Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, with genetic modification for whatever purpose, preventing extinction, boosting food crop output, whatever the case may be, I think people worry about unintended consequences. At the macro level, we've introduced species to continents where they've been pretty devastating in the past. How do we address concerns about the things we introduce, the things we tweak and modify running amok once they get out into the wild?
It's a really good question, and it's an important thing to think about whenever we think about introducing invasive species. We do, as a species, have a long history of doing stuff like this, releasing a new species, imagining that there's going to be a solution to a problem by introducing an invasive species and then it going amok, as you say. We also have a long history of driving things to extinction by overhunting them or coming up with other solutions. I think what's going to be most important is that we really engage in careful consideration of the possible risks. You know, we can't just make a decision somewhere that impacts the rest of the world. We have to start having these conversations all at once with all possible stakeholders. And, you know, it isn't really possible to do much of this stuff just yet, which is why it's important to start having these conversations now. You know, gene drives, this idea that we can pass a trait, you mentioned resistance to malaria in mosquitoes, through an entire population. One of the ways that this is being imagined is that they would introduce a trait that actually makes the mosquitoes unable to reproduce, right? So they're essentially trying to drive the mosquito population all the way down to zero. But there's also a very long conversation about how you would do this and include what they're calling a kill switch, or a way to stop this from happening. And essentially, that would be, you know, you would edit the genomes that it contains the letters that code for this particular trait, but also letters that you could turn on that stop that trait from happening. Or there's another situation where you put these gene drives in, but you attach them to other drives, and only one of them, and the one at the very end, this is kind of confusing to think about, they call it a daisy chain drive. So what you have is multiple different driving elements in the genome, but one of them doesn't get passed on. And the end consequence of all of this is that the trait that makes half of the individuals that are born not survive only lasts for a fixed number of generations, say 10 generations. So over time, fewer and fewer individuals have that trait. And then hopefully it's been a strong enough drive that the population collapses, but it doesn't stand any chance at all of persisting forever. So it's these kinds of things, kill switches and genetic changes that can't persist forever in the natural population, that people are thinking about when we're considering using these kind of tools for conservation.
A big question is who decides? I can imagine if I'm in one country in a malaria zone, I might make one decision about the mosquitoes. The neighbors across the border might make a different one, and the mosquitoes don't care about the borders. You give a smaller case in your book looking out Lyme disease resistant mice and bringing together different communities on the East Coast. How are they considering how to decide whether or not to try to fight Lyme disease with genetically modified mice?
So this is a program called Mice Against Ticks. It's led by a professor at MIT, Kevin Esfeld. And he is one of the leading speakers who's really reading thinkers about how we should be able to use gene drive technologies. So the idea here is that people who live on Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and other islands and along in the Northeast, there's a really high incidence of Lyme disease, which is debilitating disease. And so nobody wants to get this. And mice are the reservoirs for Lyme disease. So it comes, ticks bite the mice, the ticks bite the people get Lyme disease, the mice are carriers. What they would like to do is engineer mice so that they can't carry Lyme disease, that they're resistant to it in some way. And in this way, they won't be able to reinfect the ticks, and the ticks won't be infected, and then people won't be infected. But Kevin and Mice Against Ticks are adamant that the only way that you could use this sort of technology is if you have buy-in from the local communities. And so he has built these consortiums of people who live on the islands who he is working with so that they can really understand the short-term and long-term and potential consequences of these technologies. And then they are choosing. And so far, they have chosen that they don't want to use gene drives, but they do want to do something about Lyme disease. And so they're still all working together to figure out what the best solution for them is. And I think this is a great example of how scientists and stakeholders can work together. Kevin clearly feels that gene drives have strong potential to be helpful here, but he also understands that you can't just impose your will on a community, and that an action in one place is going to also have consequences to other locations. And this is the challenge that we're going to face as we start to think about these technologies. But as I said before, you know, these technologies exist. They will become increasingly powerful, and people will decide eventually that they're going to use them, whether they have global permission or stakeholder buy-in or not. So now is the time for those of us who really believe that there needs to be stakeholder buy-in to start having these conversations so that everybody can understand the technology and can invest in making decisions about what is going to impact them and their children and their communities.
In just our last minute or so, Beth, it seems like the core message of your book isn't even so much about the technology available, but the idea of responsibility. Can you talk about, given how much humans have changed the animal world, the plant world for that matter, make the case that we have some responsibility not just to step away when things go bad?
Well, you know, what I worry about the most is we all imagine when you think about conservation that we either have the choice to stand back and let nature heal on its own, to leave it alone, or to jump in and get our hands dirty. The problem is that it is too late for us to imagine that we can stand back. The pace of change today, the pace of extinction today, is way faster than what evolution by natural selection can keep up with. And this is because of us, because of the impact that we have had on habitats and species around the world. If we want to live in a world that is both biodiverse and full of humans, we're going to have to figure out how to take advantage of these technologies that allow us to meddle with species at a pace that keeps up with the changes that we are imposing on the landscapes around us.
Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Beth Shapiro is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We talked to her about her new book, Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, humankind has faced a lot of devastating diseases throughout history, and there may be some lessons we can learn today. We'll talk to the author of the new book, The Plague Cycle. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll find out how family members can cope with the challenges of caring for a loved one with dementia. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, according to the Alzheimer's Association, 6.2 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. It affects 1 in 9 people aged 65 and older. Most of them are at least 75. Caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia can be difficult as their mental and physical faculties decline and their behavior becomes unpredictable. It can be easy to feel emotionally drained, physically exhausted, and alone. Our next guest says your needs as a caregiver are just as important as the patient's and has written a new book to help provide insight, guidance, and advice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a caregiver of a family member with dementia? What was it like? What were some of your biggest challenges? Were there things that really seemed to help or some advice or resources you got that made a difference for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Andrew Budson is an associate director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center, a School of Medicine professor of neurology, and chief of cognitive and behavioral neurology at the VA Boston Healthcare System. He's co-author of the new book, 6 Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. Dr. Budson, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, there's a lot of challenges. These can be difficult conversations to have. But what I got from your book, Dr. Budson, was a lot of hope that there are a lot of practical things that real people could do that can make life a lot better. We don't have to assume that the worst case scenario is what it has to be.
Absolutely. No, it's really so true. I think people often think about, oh, you know, I have, you know, Alzheimer's, or my loved one has Alzheimer's, it's a medical problem, I need to solve it with medication. But in fact, although medications do play a small role and they can be important, it's all the things that you as a family member, as a caregiver can do that really will make the difference in your life and the life of your loved one.
You give some concrete strategies for dealing with difficult situations. First of all, can you talk about some of the day-to-day challenges you hear about from patients and other people you talk to for your book that with some strategies we can overcome?
Absolutely. So, you know, one common thing that happens is people with Alzheimer's and other dementias, they get upset. And so one reason they might get upset is that they think, because of their memory problems, that they don't live in the house they're actually living in at the present time. They think, you know, that they're in the house that they grew up in or the house they were in 30 years ago. So they might walk to the door and say, you know, I want to go home, you know. And as the caregiver, you're like, you know, hey, you already are home. But sort of reasoning with someone with dementia, you know, trying to sort of talk them out of it is not usually effective. And so we normally recommend for something like that a strategy that we call the four R's. We want to reassure our loved one that everything's okay. We want to reconsider things from their perspective, you know, that they don't understand, that they're living in a different home than they did previously. We want to redirect them to something that is both calming and will distract them from whatever it is that's upsetting them. And then the fourth R is for us as caregivers, which is relax. Take a deep breath and make sure that we're not feeling irritated or angry or upset so we don't reflect those emotions back to our loved ones.
That's the four R's. You've also got an ABC system for diagnosing these problems and what triggers them again and again to try to predict and maybe be ready to redirect. Can you talk us through your ABCs?
Absolutely. So the ABC stands for antecedents, behaviors, and consequences. And when we have a behavior that we can't manage simply with something like the four R's, we need to really dive deep and, you know, take a look at, well, what were the things that were leading up to the behavior? You know, what were the, you know, precipitants? So imagine dad is sort of yelling and screaming. And, you know, some of the antecedents to that might be that it's, you know, 5 p.m. in the evening. And it might be that, maybe he missed lunch that day, or maybe it's just that time of day, it's getting late in the evening. So we look at the antecedents, things that are leading up to the behavior. Then the B, the behavior, we want to dive deeply into it. We don't just want to say dad was yelling or screaming. We want to say he was, you know, yelling for 15 minutes. This was the content. You know, he also perhaps stamped his feet. He stamped his feet so powerfully, it shook the china in the cabinet. You know, we want to try to quantify things as much as we can. And then the C is the consequences. So what happened? You know, maybe the consequences are that, you know, we know whatever is upsetting dad, if we give him some chocolate ice cream, you know, then he'll calm down. And what we may have inadvertently reinforced is that, oh, anytime dad wants chocolate ice cream, he just has to yell and scream long enough and loud enough, and we'll give him chocolate ice cream. So we use the ABCs when behaviors are hard to sort of fix with a quick fix, and we need to think about them more carefully.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Budson. He's co-author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience yourself at giving care to a family member with some form of dementia, something that was a particular challenge to you, that is a particular challenge to you maybe right now, or solutions you found, things that helped you out, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Budson, we heard from Shirley on Facebook. Shirley writes, I have a hard time with the personality change. They used to be sweet and agreeable and are now so very stubborn. They used to care very much about their appearance, and now you can't get them to change out of dirty clothes or get their hair washed. What you think you know about your loved one is no longer the case. That's not a lot of people are going through this. Shirley isn't alone, Dr. Budson. What kind of thoughts do you have for someone in that situation?
It can be really difficult. And, you know, the first thing to say is, you know, remember that, you know, it's the disease that's doing it. It's not that, you know, your loved one suddenly you realize, oh, they're not the person I thought they were. No, they're the person they were before the disease took hold. So it's just, I think it's just helpful as a mindset to realize that, you know, it's the disease that's causing these problems. And some people do, you know, go from being sweet to being, you know, cantankerous or argumentative. And sometimes people can actually go the other way around. When people become more argumentative, sometimes it's because we're not sort of understanding how they're feeling and what is going on. Maybe their sleep has been disturbed and they're not getting good sleep. Maybe that's why they're upset. You know, but sometimes, you know, we do actually reach out for a medication. And when someone is sort of feeling, you know, frustrated or irritable about their memory problems, or they're feeling confused and they're angry because they don't know where they are and they think they should go home or something like that, a little bit of a medication that's in the Prozac family, such as sertraline, which is a brand name of Zoloft, or escitalopram, brand name of Lexapro, can sometimes help with that as well. And the last thing I'll just mention about not wanting to change their clothes, you know, that can be a problem. And, you know, I'm all about using little tricks to help with things like that, you know. So if they take their clothes off at night, you know, make sure you take those clothes and you put them out of sight, you know, put them in the washing machine, put them in the hamper, something like that. If the problem is they don't want to get out of it at all, you know, maybe you can see if they'd be willing to get into the bathtub, and that would be a way that they could change their clothes. Or you could even do something like, you know, maybe you're trying to give them a little bit of a bath and the clothes get wet and you say, oh my God, you know, I'm sorry, I got your shirt wet. I guess we'll have to take that off and put you on a dry shirt, something like that.
You also reminded me, mentioning possible prescriptions, that it could be easy to assume that any new problem is because of Alzheimer's or whatever other form of dementia somebody might have. But it could also be things like depression or anxiety, because having dementia can be very stressful, or it can be a hearing or vision problem. When should we seek medical attention and not just assume this is a straight-up consequence of dementia?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, you want to make sure you have a good diagnosis to begin with, mm-hmm. and to recognize if someone says, you know, your loved one has dementia, that tells you about sort of the scope of the problem, that it's relatively severe. It tells you that it interferes with day-to-day function. It's not actually a diagnosis in itself. You know, so you have to ask the doctor, well, what's causing the dementia? What's causing it? But you make a good point that sometimes when someone already has dementia, things can get worse. And you want to try and figure out, is it worse just because of the dementia? Or is it a side effect of a medication? Or is it that they're depressed? Or do they have a medical problem? And I think the bottom line has to be, if you are a caregiver and you are just not sure, or you're feeling uncomfortable, you know, this seemed to correlate with a new medicine, or all of a sudden this change seems rather precipitous, you definitely want to talk to the doctor and see if it's due to a medical problem, medication side effect, or something like that.
We're getting advice on providing care for loved ones with dementia. Dr. Andrew Budson is with us, Associate Director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center, co-author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a caregiver for someone with dementia, or are you right now? Or some of those difficult things, the biggest challenges you found, what kind of help did you find you needed most? What advice do you have for other people who are stepping into that role now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the challenges of caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia and getting some practical advice for people in that caregiver role. Dr. Andrew Budson stays with us from the School of Medicine at the VA and the VA Boston Healthcare System. He co-wrote a new book titled Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families, a School of Medicine at Boston University, I should say. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience you'd like to share, a challenge you have now or have had helping a loved one with dementia, call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard on Facebook from Joan, who writes, the hardest part is role reversal when the patient is a parent and not being able to comfort them and relieve all their fears when their minds can no longer comprehend the world around them. Your pain will be just as hard to bear as theirs. Dr. Budson, thoughts for somebody like Joan in that role, caring for a parent and wanting to be able to comfort them?
Yeah, I think it is, first of all, I want to comment about that role reversal, because it can be so hard for family members. You know, they're used to, you know, relating to their parent, you know, or their spouse as, sort of an independent adult with, you know, ability to sort of, you know, reason through problems with you and help you out and be rational. And now, you know, all of a sudden things are gone. And it's hard when we still have those, you know, the habits, the reflexes, the attitudes of treating our loved one the way we have, you know, for the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. And now we have to treat them in a very different way. We have to be the ones who are comforting them. We may need to treat them as, you know, someone who's not capable of, being the same person that they were before. And psychologically, that can be very hard. And it's actually one of the reasons that we wrote some little sort of story vignettes into the book that we hope will help caregivers to make that transition. And, you know, the things to do to comfort our loved ones, you know, usually when we're with them and right there and are able to, you know, be next to them and, you know, hold their hand or, you know, stroke their forehead or do comforting things, they're usually fine. Usually the difficulty is, well, we then need to go do the bills or we need to make dinner or we need to go to work or something like that. And it can be very difficult. And there are some non-pharmacological things that can help with that. Turns out music can really be a wonderful tool to helping make our loved one feel more comfortable, pulling out an old familiar tune, something that they know and like, can usually be very helpful. Other things that can be helpful include real pets, even if they were never an animal person. Many people really enjoy the comfort of an animal in this stage of life. And it turns out that once people have progressed to the moderate and severe stages, sometimes one of these robot pets that you can buy, they're sort of like, they look sort of like cats and they move a little bit like cats, but they don't run away. They just stay on your lap. Can be comforting to many people, and even a stuffed animal can be comforting. So there's a lot of things that one can do to comfort a loved one.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Andrea is with us in Menominee Falls. Andrea, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention we had a relative who had a sudden increase in the amount of dementia she was showing, and it no one could quite understand what was going on. And the sundowner's effect seemed to be worse. And what it ended up taking a very long time to find out was she had a urinary tract infection, which evidently is quite common to cause dementia type issues with especially older people. And one of the other relatives who was a nurse said, has she been tested for a urinary tract infection? You know, and so that's something that I think people should, including doctors, should keep in the back of their head, that we do have to look for other physical things.
Andrea, thanks for the call. Dr. Budson.
Oh, absolutely, Andrea. I so agree with you. And I do think that all of us doctors can sometimes be a little quick to just attribute a symptom to, oh, that's just dementia, or, yeah, they're just getting worse in the evening. We call that sundown. You know, that's all it is. But you're right. You know, everyone needs to think, you know, could this be a medical problem? Could this be a urinary tract infection? Could this be a pneumonia? Could this be a stroke? We definitely have to look for those things, particularly because they're quite treatable. So like I think I said once before, you know, if your loved one is not behaving well, if they've had a sudden turn for the worse, do call your doctors and take Andrea's advice and say, hey, what about the urine? Can you look in her urine?
Thanks for that call, Andrea. We're talking to Dr. Andrew Budson. He's co-author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. Back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Grafton. Beth, hello.
Hi. I just have a tip. My mother-in-law had Alzheimer's, and she became very difficult. She was in assisted living before she passed away. But one of my tips is just to keep your sense of humor. And my husband and I didn't laugh at her, but we still chuckle at 3 years after her death of some of the things that she said and the way that she said it. And, you know, you just kind of have to keep your sense of humor about it and realize that it is a disease and not the person. And that helped us get through that. The other thing is not to argue or try to change your mind. There were some family members that would always try to do that, and it just made everything worse. And you know, you're not going to change their mind, and they think what they think, and that's okay. And, you know, just to go along with it, it's not the end of the world for us to be told something that's not true. You know, we can put up with it. So those are my two tips.
Beth, thanks a lot for both of those pieces of advice, Dr. Budson.
Yeah, I totally agree. And a sense of humor is definitely helpful in almost everything in life. And I think your comment about, you know, not arguing and just, you know, trying to sort of change the subject, I think is sort of the way to go. And, you know, something that happens to many patients with dementia, particularly with dementia with Lewy bodies, is they'll sometimes have hallucinations and they'll see people or animals who aren't there, and they may be interacting with the person. They may say, who's that person? They may be frightened of a person, and the person's not really there. And it doesn't help to argue with them and say, oh, this person doesn't exist. I mean, you can say that once, but if it doesn't fix it, don't say it again. The key is to distract them, use those four R's, redirect them to something that's reality-based, and move on. So totally agree with you, Beth. Thank you.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Dr. Budson, can you leave us with some thoughts on caring for the health of the caregiver? I know it's easy to say do self-care, but on a practical level, what are some key things people can do?
Absolutely. So the first thing is, you know, don't try to manage someone with dementia all by yourself. You really want to build your care team. You want to enlist other family members, friends, neighbors. And even if they live in another part of the country, there's so much that can be done over the internet these days to help. Like somebody can do their online banking for them. Somebody, even if they can only come over an hour a month, well, that's an hour more, you know, that you have. And then, you know, we want all our caregivers to continue to do the things that they enjoy, continue to see their friends and make time for themselves, do things that they enjoy, make sure you eat right, exercise, take care of your own doctor's appointments, All of those things are absolutely critical, and you'll be a better caregiver if you take care of yourself.
Dr. Budson, thanks so much for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Andrew Budson, Associate Director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center. We talked to him about his new book. He's co-author of Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. Coming up, do you hate being sweaty? Our next guest wants you to find the joy in sweat and all that it can do. We'll talk about the long history of sweat and how we've tried to cover it up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.